the seduction of Eve, as we've just read it there in the book of Genesis. And I use this language of seduction because then Satan here seduces an unwilling person, Eve, into sin. We use seduction in that way, don't we? A woman unwilling to be seduced and to go to bed with a man is led by his devices, his winning words and so on, to do something that she did not want to do. And it's the same here in the Garden of Eden, isn't it? Because, of course, Eve, like Adam, was pure and holy at this point. She had no inclination towards sin, no desire to sin at all. And this is one of the fundamental problems that we have with understanding this passage, isn't it? We as fallen human beings are aware of our propensity to sin, that we have sinful desires that we wrestle against and so on. But that wasn't the case here. And so we have the particular problem then of how did Satan get an innocent person, a truly innocent, a pure and holy person to sin? How do you seduce into sin someone who has no sinful inclinations at all? It's like trying to get hold and climb up a sort of sheer block of ice with just your bare hands. Satan normally, when he flings temptations at us, has, as it were, something to grip onto, doesn't he? He's got that fallenness in us. He's got those sinful weaknesses he's aware of in us to kind of get some purchase, to get some grip, to feel he's got an opportunity of getting hold and drawing us into sinning against our God. But it wasn't so with Eve, was it? Pure, holy, innocent then in the fullest sense, no inclination towards sin at all. For us, it's true what James says in chapter 1, isn't it? Each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. Then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, gives birth to death. That's what we're used to. Again, Paul in Romans and elsewhere, he talked about God's law being holy and righteous and good, but also that God's law was a means for propagating and increasing sin. And says, well, how can this be? Well, it's not a problem with God's law, which is holy and good. The problem was in us and our sinful desires. It's our sinful fleshly nature. But there was no such nature for Eve. And so it's this then seduction of Eve, this innocent, and through her Adam, another innocent, of course, being seduced into sin, that I'd like us to focus on tonight and next week. But tonight I'm not going to focus on the process that we read in chapter 3 itself. I'm going to leave that for next week, because in preparation for that, there are some issues that often get in the way of focusing on this process of temptation or seduction. And there are three particular ones that get asked. Why Eve? Why was it that Satan targeted Eve, not Adam? Where was Adam, anyway? Where was Adam when this was going on? And I mean that question both literally and metaphorically, as we'll see. And then what was this tree, anyway? What was the meaning of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? And I'll spend most of the time concentrating on that last question about what was this tree? What was it about? What was there for? Because that's crucial to a proper understanding of the process of temptation or seduction of Eve into sin. But also because, again, I think they're sometimes distracting, we need to answer the other two questions. Why Eve and where was Adam? So three questions. Why, where and what? Why Eve? Where was Adam, and what's the meaning of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? So first of all then, why Eve? Well, as many of you know, the answer to that question that's often been given, or at least in my experience, is to do with woman being the weaker sex. Women are said to be weaker, therefore more vulnerable in some sense, perhaps more gullible to the wiles, the temptations that Satan brings. And therefore Satan, being aware of this, chooses to focus on the woman as allegedly the weaker person rather than on Adam. And I think that's wrong. I do not think that's the reason why he chose Eve. That's not because I deny differences between men and women. We're all conscious that we live in very strange days, don't we? When fundamental differences between men and women are widely denied. It's bizarre because down the ages and to us, it's so obvious that men and women are not identical. That we're different anatomically, physiologically, hormonally, psychologically, and so on. There are fundamental differences built into who we are as human beings, male and female. But although women are different from men, or men are different from women, I don't think that has any bearing on what's going on in Genesis 3. I don't think it's why Satan chose Eve. I don't think it's why he thought she was somehow weaker psychologically and more vulnerable to the particular temptation that he brought. I see nothing in the text or elsewhere in the Bible to support that approach. Rather, I think the answer is more obvious, but sadly often missed. Why Eve? Because she wasn't there. Eve was not there when God gave this prohibition to Adam. In chapter 2, as we've read, he gave the prohibition to not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil to Adam alone. Eve was not yet created, was she? It was sometime later, as we read in the following verses, that Eve was created. So she wasn't there. And I think that's crucial. Because we all know that it's much easier to trick somebody, to mislead somebody about what someone else has said, if that person wasn't there. How many preachers have found their sermon misrepresented by the fact that somebody who wasn't there has been picked up on a misunderstanding about what was said in the sermon. Because they weren't there, they hear bits and pieces. They hear a second-hand report from someone who was there. And misunderstanding what went on, they get it completely wrong and represent the poor preacher as propagating some error or heresy, which he never said at all. And because Eve wasn't there, and because Eve must have learned from Adam second-hand what had been said, then she was that much more vulnerable to having a misrepresentation by Satan of what was said. So why Eve? Because she wasn't there. And secondly then, where was Adam? Relatedly, where was Adam? Well, of course, Adam was there physically, wasn't he? Adam was there with his wife throughout what we read. We read that in chapter 3 in verse 6. When the woman saw the tree was good for food, that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desired to make one wise, she took the fruit and ate, and she gave some to her husband who was with her. So Adam was there throughout what we read. Eve wasn't there when the prohibition was given. That's, I think, very important. But Adam was there when the temptation, the seduction of his wife took place. And that's very important too, isn't it? Because another reason related to the why Eve question is because Satan knew that in going for Eve, he was also undermining the relationship, the marriage of the husband and the wife. And Adam is clearly greatly guilty here for his failure to intervene when Satan comes and starts talking to his wife. Because he was there. He should have intervened and said, well, hang on a minute, Satan. I was there when God gave that command. I was there. And this is what he said. He could have said to Eve, well, hang on, Eve. Just hang on. Just let me tell you. I was there. Let me tell you exactly what God said to me. But he didn't, did he? It's part of the tragedy here. Adam lamentably failed in his duty as the husband here to intervene and speak up. And yes, Eve also failed because she was seduced into sin by the serpent, and she took and ate the fruit which he should not have eaten. And Paul, when he writes to Timothy, in 1 Timothy, makes it clear that it was Eve who was deceived and became a transgressor. She's certainly guilty. But nonetheless, her husband Adam is also guilty in what held, of course, as guilty in the Bible, isn't he? He too was involved very much. But by failure then to act as the husband and the leader at this crucial point of the temptation or seduction by Satan of his wife. So although we can say that Adam was there, you know, where was Adam? Well, he was there with his wife. He was not there metaphorically. Might not be the most clear way of putting it. You can say he went AWOL, didn't he? He was absent when he should have been there to speak up for his wife. He stood back and remained silent when he should have intervened. He deserted his wife in her hour of need. He failed in that. You know, sometimes somebody will say to a good friend, I'll always be there for you. I'll always be there for you. And we know what they mean, don't they? If you're in trouble, if you're in distress, call me. I will be there for you to help you. And Adam was not there in that sense for his wife. And he should have been, and he failed and sinned. So, to clear those two things, why Eve? She wasn't there when the command was given. Where was Adam? Well, he was there, but he wasn't there as he should have been to intervene, to speak up, to help his wife, and to resist Satan. So he too was guilty and is held, of course, as guilty in the scriptures. But then most time then on the key question about this tree, what was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? What is going on here? So the Garden of Eden, the tree, it always feels very unreal, doesn't it? It's a very strange kind of place because it's so different from the world as we experience it today. It's paradise on earth in the Garden of Eden. It's heaven on earth. And as we've said before, then when the Lord gave the creation mandate to Adam to go forth, and to fill the earth, to multiply and to fill the earth, the aim God has was that the earth would be covered, would be filled with worshippers of God. That the earth would be populated by men and women who loved and served God. That was the creation mandate, to fill the earth with the knowledge of the glory of God, with masses, multitudes of men and women like you and me loving and worshipping God. That was the purpose that God had when he said, fill the earth, that the garden, the paradise garden of Eden, would be extended over the whole uncultivated world. But there was a risk, a danger, wasn't there, in this original situation. The danger was of sin coming in. It was a vulnerable or a fragile setter, wasn't it? That as Adam and Eve served God and multiplied and their offspring began to fill the earth, there was always the possibility of someone sinning against God and causing the whole thing to fall apart. It was fragile. There was no security. And that was why then the Lord gave the command not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. As has been said before from this pulpit then, this is something that theologians sometimes refer to as the covenant of life or the covenant of creation, or a not very good term, the covenant of works. I don't like the term because works normally means sinful people not being able to keep them, whereas these were pure and holy people who could obey. But the giving of this command, I think we often think, was a kind of strange thing, because we might think, well, there's Adam and Eve. They have the law of God written on their hearts. As those made in the image of God, as we considered before, they know what we call the moral law. They know what's right and wrong and how to serve God, but there's a possibility of sin and all the consequences. And then God comes along and he says, look, there's this tree here of knowledge of good and evil. Don't eat of it, or you will die, and all these consequences will follow. And we think, well, hasn't God just made it worse? Hasn't he now created an extra opportunity for sin? And indeed, it is that sin that brought the fall with all its consequences. Didn't the Lord make it worse by saying, don't eat of this tree? And that's, of course, not the case. God did not make it worse by putting that tree there. What he was doing then, with this covenant, as it's been called, was to make the possibility of Adam securing eternal life, making the heaven that they were to establish on earth not vulnerable to sin, not fragile anymore, but secure and assured and everlasting. Adam and Eve then, by not eating, all they had to do was not do something. There's no deeds to carry out. There's no task to undertake. Just don't eat. Got all these other trees. Don't eat of that one. And after some time, you'll be secure forever and ever. So it was a good reason why God established this command, why God gave this command, establishing then this covenant. It was for the good of mankind. It wasn't to trip Adam up. There was no, of course, malicious intent. It wasn't a bad thing. It was a good thing. But again, you might think, well, Alan, I don't see anything about this in the text. I don't see anything here about a covenant. And I don't see anything here about this securing eternal life or anything like that. You're reading this into the text. Well, I agree. I agree. I would add that what I'm reading here into the text, I'm reading into the text along with multitudes of theologians down the ages. It isn't something I've just made up, of course. It's something we've preached here before, and it's been taught down the ages. But the fundamental point is, it isn't written explicitly in the text. But there's a good reason for that. And we'll find out the reason as we carry on thinking about what's going on here in the Garden of Eden. There's a good reason why the Lord didn't spell it all out like I've just done to you. So the tree then of the knowledge of good and evil, it's there, it's for a good reason. It's to enable Adam and Eve to establish securely forever humanity in heaven on earth. But then what was the meaning of this tree? Why is it called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? What's going on here with this? Well, the term or the phrase knowledge of good and evil is used only a few times in the Bible. And it should be understood as a single word, if you like, good and evil. It's not different things. It's understood as one thing, one meaning. And it's the commentators point to three uses later in the Bible that help us to understand what's going on here. First of all, in Genesis chapter 24 and verse 50, when Laban and Bethuel reply to Abraham's servant saying, we cannot speak to you good and bad or good and evil. Now that chapter 24 is where Abraham has sent this servant to go and find a wife for his son Isaac. He doesn't want Isaac to marry one of the Canaanite women. He sends his servant off back to where he came from, somewhere in what it's called Babylonia, to find then from among his wider family someone to be a wife for his son Isaac. And so the servant makes the long journey. He gets there, and you remember the story about how he prays to the Lord that if the woman would come down and she would draw water from the well, and so on. And so of course it's Rebecca who's the woman who comes down and draws the water and offers it to him and his camels, etc. And thereby shows to his servant that this woman, Rebecca, is the chosen one, the wife chosen for Isaac. And so when the servant explains all this to Laban and Bethuel, they then reply saying, well, you know, we can't speak good or evil. Which seems a peculiar reply to us, I think. But what it means in context is we can't make a different decision from what's clearly been decided by God. God has clearly, by these events you've just described, showed very clearly he has chosen Rebecca for Isaac. That's his decision, God's decision. So we can't decide for a different decision. We can't go against God and decide differently. So this is about decision making. Or again in Deuteronomy chapter 139 we read, as for your little ones who said, whom you said would become a prey, and your children who today have no knowledge of good or evil, they shall go in there. And to them I will give it, the land of Canaan, and they shall possess it. So in this context then, it's the little ones, the children, the young children, who don't have the knowledge of good and evil, meaning they're not old enough to understand right and wrong and how to make decisions about what's right and wrong. They don't yet have that awareness of right and wrong to make morally correct decisions. Again, it's about decision making. And most clearly, and probably most well known, is in 1 Kings in chapter 3, when Solomon prays for wisdom. Solomon prays for wisdom to the Lord, and he asks the Lord to bless him, quote, with an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil, who is able to govern this great people of yours. I think it's most clear here that this phrase, good and evil, is to do with decision making. Making the right decisions in God's service. Solomon is keenly aware of his youth at this point, of the immense responsibility he's been entrusted with as king, that he's got to act as judge and ruler, and he's going to have an enormous number of complex decisions to make. He needs wisdom to be able to decide between good and evil, to make the correct decisions in the service of God as the king. So all these, or three of these other uses, are to do with decision making, making correct decisions. And so the commentators say, you know, that this thing about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, it was to do with moral autonomy. They use the language of moral autonomy. Moral autonomy is not perhaps a phrase that we would find very easy either. We might say it's about learning to think for yourselves. Would be a more lay way of talking about moral autonomy. It's a way of learning to think for yourself. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, it's about moral autonomy, making correct decisions, learning to think for yourselves. But I don't like the phrase moral autonomy, or indeed what I've used to simplify it, learning to think for yourselves. And the reason is because what we've seen is this is about correct decision making in the service of God. It's about wisdom in the service of God. And the later in the scriptures, it's very clear that wisdom is based on the fear of God. That making correct decisions in scripture is about godly decisions. It's about decisions in the face of God. Not autonomous decisions. That a mature human being is not someone who makes autonomous decisions without reference to anyone else, even to God himself. Our culture wants to emphasize that. Our culture emphasizes autonomy. It says you need to learn to think for yourselves and make your decisions on your own and stand on your own two feet. And that is not the biblical approach. The biblical approach is wisdom comes from conferring with other people. It comes from making decisions in relationships with other people, and most of all in relationship with God. Wisdom comes from God. And from the fear of God. The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. Beginning not in a temporal sense, but meaning as the foundation. The foundation, the ground on which we build a wise life is the fear of God. And so when we think of the Garden of Eden and this decision making, making correct decisions in the service of God is what it's about. It's wisdom in the service of God. And that the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was to do with this, making correct decisions in the service of God and wisdom, is in fact, I think, suggested by what we read of in Eve's response, isn't it, to the serpent's temptation. Note in verse 6 that she says she sees that the tree is good for food, a delight to the eyes, and desired to make one wise. So she is in some way aware that wisdom is related to this tree. More than that, Satan, in his process of seduction, has used the language of being like God, hasn't he? He's saying, you'll be like God. And he says, yes, I could be like God and becoming wise. And part of the deceit of Satan here is then taking these things which are correct, that it's becoming mature people. The tree was to enable then Adam and Eve to learn how to make wise decisions by living in the fear of God. And living in the fear of God, making wise decisions, would mature them. It would make them more like God, godly people. They would be like God. That was part of the aim. Satan uses this, that it would make them like God. Satan uses that it's to do with wisdom. And we'll reflect on that at greater length next week. But this then is the meaning of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, to do with decision making in the service of God. But it's also important that we then go back to what I said earlier when I said, you know, well, actually, this thing about the covenant and securing eternal life isn't in the text, is it? It's not in the text. But I hope you can see now why that has to be so. Why that has to be so. Because you see, for Adam and Eve, this command to eat the tree was arbitrary. It was arbitrary. So they knew that it was related somehow to gaining wisdom and to becoming like God. And that's correct for the reasons we've seen. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil is to do with gaining wisdom, making correct decisions, maturing then as men and women in the service of God, becoming more godlike. But the command itself and the not eating then of the tree is arbitrary. It's not like God's moral law then. So when we think of God's moral law and the commandments as we have them later in Scripture for God's moral law, then we often make arguments about why these are good laws, don't we? We say there are good reasons why keeping God's laws. There are good reasons for keeping God's laws. They lead to good things. The Christian Institute bases much of its activity on declaring why keeping God's laws is the best thing for society. And they're right to do that, because it's true. They're not killing people, not undermining life in the womb or later. It's a good thing for society. That honouring marriage and being faithful in relationships, and especially in marriage, is a good thing for society generally, a good thing for ourselves, for our relationships, but for society. And of course, this applies to all the commandments, and these arguments have been made again and again, and rightly so, down the ages. So when it comes to keeping the moral law, these commandments, then one of the reasons people keep them, who aren't even Christians, is because they can see it makes sense. They can see good reasons for doing so. They're not arbitrary, in other words. They're not arbitrary. They relate to the character of God himself, who we are like as his image, and therefore what's best for us overall. But that's not true of this command to not eat. This is arbitrary. Adam and Eve couldn't make arguments about why there was benefit for themselves in not eating. They knew in some sense it was going to bring wisdom and so on. Well, they did not know that it could secure eternal life, because they weren't told that. That's not in the text, because God didn't tell them and he didn't lay it down then for them. Because, of course, if he had, it would have changed the whole point, wouldn't it? The point then of the arbitrary command is it's a pure test of obedience to God. It's a pure test of obedience to the Lord, isn't it? The reason that you've got to keep this command is simply because God says so. Simply because God says it's best. And you keep a command that's arbitrary because God says so, simply because you fear him and you want to honour him and serve him faithfully. For no other reason. Not because you think it makes sense. Not because you think it's going to have some better outcome from your life or your family or anything. But simply because God says so. I've got a book on my shelf that sometimes people, when they see it, they ask about. Because it's called Picking Up a Pin for the Lord. Picking Up a Pin for the Lord. And it's a quote from a Reformed Baptist who was a humble chap, a cobbler or something in the 18th century. And he said to somebody inquiring about him being a Christian who would serve the Lord faithfully, he said, I will do anything that God tells me to. Even if he just tells me to pick up a pin, I will do that for the Lord. No questions asked. Because he was a man who honoured God and who wanted to please God. Even when he couldn't understand why any command was a command from God for him to keep, he would keep it. And this command then, to not eat then, if Adam and Eve had been told, look, all you have to do is hang on for a few weeks, you know, a little time, during this probationary period, in this covenant, And after a while then, you won't, you know, I'll make sure, says God, that you'll never be able to sin after that. I'll secure heaven on earth for you now. If you can just do this for this short period of time and refrain from eating this tree, then you'll have this fantastic reward. Well, of course, that completely changes it, doesn't it? How much easier it would have been for Adam and Eve if God had spelled all that out like that. And so there's this fantastic reward of heaven forever and ever if you simply don't eat this fruit for a little while. But it wouldn't then have been the pure test of their commitment to and obedience to God that this commandment was. So they understood something of it. They should have kept it because it was to make them mature, growing in obedience to God. So they kept that command. They would learn that fearing God and becoming wise is about doing what God says, even when we can't find a reason for it, even when it might not make any sense, even when it's completely arbitrary. We obey God because God says so. But another key point then, as we draw to a close then, is that although they didn't understand that, and I think that's crucial to what's going on, the whole covenant of life thing and the eternal benefits, the command that was given, don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that prohibition was a good command because they understood it would make them wise and mature them as human beings in the service of God, to become like God, as they grew in submission to him by not eating, and by, of course, keeping the other commands that the Lord had written on their hearts, being faithful in their relationships, etc. Because Adam and Eve were immature, they were innocent, but they were innocent as immature people, with no experience, of course, at the beginning of life at all. They needed to mature, they needed to grow. And the means by which they were to grow and mature was keeping God's commands, including explicitly this arbitrary command of not eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And by doing that, they would become wise. By doing that, they would grow as mature, grow into mature, ever more mature, God-like human beings. So that the command was a good one. It was a good command from God, in that sense, as well as in the ultimate sense, that they didn't know. And had they had that knowledge, I think it would have undermined the whole point of what's going on here. But they did know that God intended some level of good from it in terms of maturing and growing in wisdom. But of course, then Satan says, as he said to Jesus later in the wilderness, you know, you can have a shortcut here. You can become like God. You become wise simply by eating of the fruit. There's no need with all this boring, obedient stuff. There's no need to hold yourself back from enjoying it. God knows you can become wise, just enjoy eating the fruit. Get there the easy way, the quick way, without all the pain of obedience and submission to God. But as we close then, you see Satan then cloaks the good, becoming mature and wise, with that devious twist of the means. The end was good. The means that they chose was evil. It's often said, of course, the end does not justify the means. And that was very much the case here. The end was a good one. The means an evil one. And this is often the way Satan goes, isn't it? In temptation. This was a unique situation. As I've said earlier on, this is unique, of course, because they were totally innocent. But one of the ways when we think about fighting against temptation, resisting these enticements of the evil one, we often focus then on our sinful weaknesses that I mentioned earlier on. You know, I've got particular predilections, sins in certain direction, I'm my weakness and so on. Identify your weaknesses, know yourself. And that's all good and correct. But of course, there's other elements to take into account, isn't there? And one of them is the fact that a good goal, a good end, Satan can dupe us, deceive us into going for that good end with bad or evil means. So you want to get promotion at work. You want to be successful and get promotion at work, and that's a good thing. To do your job well, to have that recognised in that way, is a good thing. It's a noble aim and ambition. Now, of course, there could be sinful motivations that go with that, that we would rightly think of. But also then the means to attain that end need to be the right one. You may be aware that colleagues in the workplace will fiddle the books a little, that they will lie a bit about their achievements in order to help themselves to gain that promotion. But you and I won't do that. Because we're not going to use evil means. Tempting though it may be, we won't use evil means to gain a noble end. Colleagues might go about and seek to undermine potential rivals for a promotion by putting about gossip or slandering the person, knowing that the boss will pick up this. But of course, we won't behave in those ways to achieve a noble end. We can have good ends. We don't use bad, evil means to get them. Or as a church, we want people to come to faith in Jesus Christ. We want to win people to faith in him and to join us as worshippers of God. But the means we choose in evangelism have to be means that also are pleasing and honouring to God. And we will not pander to the world with entertainments and jokes and such like in order to kind of try and win people over. We won't use bad means for the godly ends of converting sinners to worshippers of God. But it is a means that Satan uses, isn't it, to tempt us into sin, reminding us of the noble end, as he did to Eve and to Adam, be like God, grow in wisdom, but using the wrong means. In her case then, of taking of the fruits. We need then to learn this lesson from the garden, and next week, God willing, we will learn further lessons then in this seduction by Satan of Eve. Let us close with hymn number 700.